Hi, I'm Dan Dunn, the host of What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, a show that mixes history, culture, politics, famous people, and booze, and strains it through the cognitive mesh of my sozzled gray matter. Join me each week as I take a lighthearted stroll through the consequential role that alcohol has played through the ages, and how it shaped key moments in history, quite literally changing the world. For instance, did you know that Thomas Jefferson started the first U.S. wine company in Virginia with investments from George Washington and Ben Franklin? It's true. And if you're wondering whose winery sits across the street from Jefferson's estate today, here's a hint. What's orange, president, and has a very good brain and the best people. I'll also tell you about new stuff to drink, trends, recipes, and other things that are good to know. And I'll chat up celebrities, along with the movers and shakers of the adult beverage world. And since this is a show about alcohol, I'd like to remind you that drinking can cause memory loss. Or even worse, memory loss. Where was I? Oh, right. Plugging my show. It's called What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. It's fun, I promise. So come on, pull up a bar stool, and let's kick it.
Hello, and welcome to Care Talk, where we talk about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America and answer your health insurance and healthcare questions. Please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. And be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Today, our special guest is Allison Orris, the Senior Fellow and Director of Medicaid Policy at Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So let's start by talking about what is Medicaid and how it works in our healthcare system.
Absolutely. Thank you for starting there. I think the thing about Medicaid that I think is often not as well understood is just how many people's lives it touches. Currently today, there are about 72 million people in our country who get their health coverage through Medicaid. That includes newborn babies, children, low-income parents, seniors, people with disabilities, folks living in nursing homes, as well as about 20 million people, adults with low income, who gained coverage after the Affordable Care Act in the 40 states and the District of Columbia that expanded Medicaid post-ACA. So Medicaid really touches people at all stages of life and is a really critical part of our healthcare system. KFF has done some recent polling that indicates that about two-thirds of people, of adults in our country, have some connection to Medicaid, their mom, their kid, otherwise, and that it's also a very popular program, which is something that I like to remind people. We've got a lot of policymakers saying that they're not going to cut in the budget debates Medicare or Social Security, and I think it's important to realize that Medicaid is popular across Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and you know, one of the things that we talk a lot about is that Medicaid should also not be subject to deep cuts as part of a budget negotiation.
That's good to know. And also, I think it's important to remind folks that Medicaid covers more people than Medicare and the Affordable Care Act, so that even though people may not understand the difference between Medicare and Medicaid, Medicaid, one way or another, it touches everyone.
That's right. And, you know, we often think about Medicare is the coverage source for people who are seniors. There are a lot of senior citizens who get help affording their Medicare premiums through Medicaid. Or if you've ever had a grandparent living in a nursing home, Medicare doesn't help with the costs of nursing homes, but Medicaid does. So just, you know, I think painting the picture of who Medicaid covers is really important as we think about policy discussions.
And speaking of policy, this week the House and the Senate are working to pass their own separate budget resolutions. Can you explain this process and what it could mean for Medicaid?
Absolutely. So there have been some, you know, discussions, and I know on your show recently about funding the government and potential government shutdown on March 14th. We're going to put that to the side because the budget resolution that I'm talking about and going to be talking about is the sort of spending blueprint for mandatory spending, for spending on Medicare, spending on Medicaid. What is the path forward on tax cuts? And the way that this budget resolution works is the House and the Senate each pass their own budget resolution. And typically, in order for it to be a binding joint resolution, they need to agree on the same resolution. This is, you know, a process that some years we don't actually have a budget resolution, which is a whole other conversation. But the reason that this conversation is so important right now is that the Republican Congress, with its relatively thin margins, is seeking to use a process called the budget reconciliation, which gives some protections to legislation that will emerge later in the year, consistent with the budget resolutions that we're talking about. Budget reconciliation legislation has protections primarily in the Senate so that it can be passed with a simple majority. So we're really at the start of what I like to talk about as a two-step process. First, the House and the Senate pass a joint resolution, a joint budget resolution, and that's what unlocks this opportunity for reconciliation legislation to be passed later in the year. The reconciliation legislation is where we're going to see actual policies. Are there tax cuts? Are there cuts to Medicaid? Right now, the budget resolution is basically setting up a roadmap for that legislation. And it's very important because what the resolution, what the budget resolution says, will direct the committees with jurisdiction over various programs to craft legislation later this year. And those committees have to follow the rules in the budget resolution in order to have the protection to get through the Senate with only 50 votes. So I know that that is a lot of detail, but where we are in the process right now is that last week the Senate passed its budget, the Senate passed its budget resolution, which paves the way for some tax cuts, some spending cuts. The House is headed to a vote on its budget resolution, potentially as early as Tuesday. And the House budget resolution is what you may be reading in the news has set up at least $880 billion in potential cuts to Medicaid. And the way that this works is that the budget resolution says Energy and Commerce Committee, that's the committee that has jurisdiction over Medicaid, you've got to cut spending in the budget reconciliation language legislation by $880 billion. It also, in the budget resolution, sets the stage for tax cuts. So we're in an environment where the House is considering major tax cuts to be paid for by cutting Medicaid, cutting nutrition programs, cutting other programs. And that's what we're expecting the House to vote on later this week. That will then lead to a process where the House and the Senate need to come to agreement on a joint budget resolution to sort of sync up their approach for moving forward. Because right now we've got two very different approaches in the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And so we'll get to what happens if the House passes one thing and the Senate passes another. What happens if the Senate passed their thing, which they already did? What happens if the House does not pass something in the next couple weeks?
So there's a couple options. The House could take up the Senate's resolution. That's one option. Or we could just sort of move on. And there's opportunities for legislation to emerge later in the year that could threaten Medicaid, could threaten other social programs, but it wouldn't have that reconciliation protection. And so then we would be in an environment where the Senate would need 60 votes, which would require some Democratic support to make major policy changes, either tax cuts or spending cuts. I should also say that because of some technical details about the budget process, the House and the Senate could try again later in the year. And that's actually one of the sort of sticking points right now. The House is sort of operating on the approach of one big reconciliation bill that would deal with tax cuts, that would deal with immigration, border, all of those kind of different policy ideas that are on the Republican policy agenda. The House is thinking do that in one bill. The Senate has been saying, let's do this piecemeal. So their smaller budget resolution that passed last week, sort of set the stage for the first of two bills. So there's a lot of uncertainty about what might happen later in the year. But I think you can see from some of the news that we've been seeing that the House is really pushing to advance its vision of a bill that would essentially cut Medicaid to finance major tax cuts.
And so speaking of what's at stake for Medicaid, the House is working on its bill this week. Do we have any idea how they would get the savings that they're looking for, the cutting over $800 billion from Medicaid? What would that look like?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, one of the things about this process is that they don't have to say very much in the budget resolution. But we have some clues from past year's budgets, from Project 2025, from articles where members have thrown ideas out there. And so we think that the $880 billion could come from policies like taking coverage away from people who don't meet work requirements, despite the fact that most Medicaid enrollees already work. We could see changes to the Medicaid matching rate. The states and the federal government currently share in funding for Medicaid. There are a number of policy changes on the table that could change those formulas or that could change some of the rules of the road, potentially even capping the federal government's commitment. All of the changes that we are seeing potentially on the table would likely shift costs to states. They would be left with a big hole in their budgets and would drive changes in eligibility, reductions in eligibility. People could lose coverage. They could lose benefits. They could have higher costs. We could see providers suffering if their rates are dropped. Although we don't have specifics, when you look at the sort of policy proposals we've seen in the past and you look at, you know, how the math adds up, it's really hard to see how we wouldn't see across the board people being harmed by the cuts of the magnitude that are currently being discussed in Congress.
I think that's an important point that some legislators may say that they are not cutting benefits, that they're cutting out waste and so on, but their whole math relies on finding billions of dollars in savings. And where do you get savings? From cuts. So everything they're planning, they are planning for people to lose their health insurance because that's where the money is. And that's what they need to pay for the tax giveaways to billionaires.
That's right. And I think the important thing at this stage of the debate is that the budget resolution will lock Congress into a path to make those cuts. And so it's important right now to be calling out, just as you just did, the fact that an $880 billion cut or even a cut anywhere in that neighborhood is going to harm people. And certainly, you know, it's we can have a conversation about addressing fraud, but this is not about fraud. This is about cutting coverage and hurting people's access to healthcare, which is not, you know, what was a topic in the election, I think, to any degree. This will make coverage more expensive for people and result in people losing coverage and having increased hardship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was not discussed last year. And I think people are understandably upset that this is being sprung out of nowhere. And in fact, last week, the president pledged not to touch Medicaid, but he also supported the House budget that cuts Medicaid. So is it possible to not touch Medicaid and get $880 billion in savings from Medicaid?
I think that's, you know, there's a challenge there to connect those statements. And that's why this is a really important moment. And we've seen some members of Congress in both the House and the Senate talking about how, you know, $880 billion is too deep of a cut, because it's just impossible to protect the people who get their health coverage through Medicaid at that level of cuts to the program.
And we'll be talking a little later about Medicare Advantage, which is a separate issue, and there's funding there. But focusing on Medicaid, what should people be looking for this week? What could happen, and what can people do about it?
I think the next milestone on Monday evening, the House Rules Committee is slated to meet and to sort of plan for a vote in the House. And then we could see a vote in the House as early as Tuesday to advance the budget resolution. We know that there are many people making calls to express their concerns about the level of cuts that's being considered in Congress. And so that, you know, I think is ongoing this week. But to continue to remind lawmakers about the ways in which Medicaid impacts people and how cuts would impact communities across the country. And, you know, we certainly talk about, you know, every state has a high number of Medicaid enrollees, every district. But when we think about rural communities, when we think about people of color, those are populations that could be disproportionately impacted. And you know, certainly I think understanding that cuts of the magnitude that the House is considering don't leave people untouched is really important in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us and explaining everything, Allison. And how can people keep following the research and information that the Center on Budget is putting out about the budget?
Well, that is a great question. Thank you for asking it. Our website is www.cbpp.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter and Blue Sky, both our organization as well as individuals who work in particular policy areas, both Medicaid and tax and budget. So we hope you'll follow us.
Thanks again, Allison. And next, we're going to answer some of your questions. This first question came in via email from Alice from Virginia, who is out of her Eliquis prescription and no way to afford reordering from the new Gap insurance company. And her husband has surgery and the hospital wants money. So Alice is in a tough situation, has run out of this medication, and cannot afford a reorder yet. So to give us some thoughts for what Alice's resources might be, welcome Louise Norris from healthinsurance.org.
Hey, Laura. So this is a tough situation. Eliquis is obviously a very necessary medication if you need it, and running out is not ideal. So it's not clear from this question what type of insurance this person has, whether Alice's coverage actually covers Eliquis or does not. It's possible that what's needed here is prior authorization or an appeal, both of which her doctor can help with filing that with the health plan. If it turns out that the health plan just does not cover her Eliquis at all, she could potentially use the Patient Assistance Foundation that Bristol-Myers Squibb has. That is the manufacturer of Eliquis. And Eliquis is one of their medications that's eligible for assistance through their Patient Assistance Foundation. You can go on their website and they will explain the eligibility requirements. There are income requirements. You have to prove that your coverage won't cover it. But then you can get help with the cost of the medication. The other part of Alice's question was regarding payment. It sounds like the hospital is requesting payment for a medical bill that her husband had. This is the sort of thing where you can contact the hospital and ask about payment plans that are more manageable than what they're, you don't have to take their first offer. Basically, you can try to set up something that works better within your budget. You can also inquire whether there are charity care programs available that could be of some help in terms of getting a bill reduced so that you don't end up having to pay the whole thing. And again, it depends on your income and what programs are available through that hospital.
Great. And as we mentioned before, you can go to $4.org and see what hospital charity options there might be available for that hospital. And our next question came from Benjamin, who is on a Medicare Advantage, yet has zero support. I had a brain tumor removed and had to switch counties, and now I can't get a social worker assigned to me from my new county, and I need help. So, welcome, Diane Archer from Just Care and Social Security Works. And do you have any thoughts or suggestions for Benjamin or people in a situation like Benjamin's?
Right. This is a tough situation. And there fortunately are some resources that Benjamin and others can use in this situation. Unfortunately, as a general rule, no insurer covers social worker services. And maybe in this case, Benjamin's Medicare Advantage plan is providing these additional benefits. We just don't know. But Medicare doesn't cover social worker services. So I would start by recommending, Benjamin, that you go to your local state health insurance assistance program, because they will be able to work with you to understand what your situation is specifically, and help you also find out or learn about free resources in your community. And each community has different resources. So start by contacting that local, it's called a SHIP, State Health Insurance Assistance Program. You can find them at shiphelp.org or by calling 877-839-2675. If you have any trouble getting through or getting the help you need, you might also try contacting the Medicare Right Center for free help. That might be easier, and you can find them at 800-333-4114. A couple of other thoughts here. One is contact your local hospital. Hospitals tend to have social workers, discharge departments with social workers. And it may be that the hospital can provide you with the services you need. It's hard to know, but it's worth trying. Also, just keep in mind that Medicare does cover some home care, but only if you're homebound. I'm not sure if that's your situation. It also covers rehab services, including therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy. So those services your Medicare Advantage plan should absolutely be paying for. One last piece of advice is, if none of those avenues work, and I'm hopeful that they will for you, you might also try calling your local member of Congress, your congressperson or your senator, because they tend to have people in their offices that can help guide you through a process and, you know, again, fingers crossed, give you the services that you need.
Thank you, Diane. Our next question is from Chris on Threads, who got a letter this weekend that our healthcare had ended at the beginning of the month, which was odd considering we renewed it with my husband's job in January during open enrollment. But turns out the small local company that he works for couldn't afford their parts, so they just canceled health insurance coverage and didn't tell anyone. And now my kids have no insurance. So I'm not sure if that's legal or what is this person's options, Louise?
Yeah, so this is a scary situation for sure. Employers can stop offering benefits. It sounds like that's what happened in this case. The good news is that does count as involuntary loss of coverage, which means you qualify for a special enrollment period. That can be either to sign up for coverage through another employer. So in this case, Chris's husband's job was the one offering benefits. If Chris's employer offers benefits, the family can transition to that plan because of the loss of their other coverage, even though it's outside of Chris's employer's open enrollment period. If that isn't available, then the family can go in the marketplace and get health insurance. And again, even though open enrollment has ended for 2025, this involuntary loss of coverage triggers a special enrollment period. So the you would need the letter that shows that you lost that coverage. That is your proof that you qualify for a special enrollment period. And if you are don't have access to another employer's plan, you'll be going through the marketplace, which just started healthcare.gov. There are 20 states that don't use healthcare.gov. If you're in one of them, you will just be directed to the correct state-run website. So you can start at healthcare.gov no matter where you live. And then depending on your household income, you might qualify for financial assistance with the coverage. One other thing, since Chris mentioned their kids don't have health insurance, Medicaid and CHIP are available to kids at higher income levels than Medicaid for adults. So sometimes families in this situation will find out that their kids actually qualify for Medicaid or CHIP, even though the parents need to obtain other private health insurance. The marketplace will help you figure that out. So if you go in the marketplace and put in your household information as far as everybody's ages and total income, it will tell you whether anyone in the household qualifies for Medicaid or CHIP, and then who qualifies for marketplace, you know, private marketplace plans instead. If you want coverage, it sounds like this coverage ended on at the end of January, the old work coverage. So in order to get a new plan in place by March 1st, you do need to submit the application by February 28th. So your special enrollment period for marketplace plans continues for 60 days after the loss of coverage. So it would actually continue through March as well. But the longer you wait, the bigger your gap will be. If you don't sign up until March 1st, your plan won't take effect until April 1st, which means you'd have a 2-month gap instead of a 1-month gap.
Thank you, Louise. Our next question is actually more of a comment. Senator Elizabeth Warren on Threads mentioned that we could root out dirty tricks by private insurers that boost their profits by manipulating claims and denying coverage in Medicare Advantage. Experts estimate that those insurers overcharged taxpayers by at least $83 billion in 2024 alone. So when we're talking about possible cuts to Medicaid, this is something to look at that could actually be fraud and save the government money if the government took action. So Diane, tell us more about this.
Okay. So I'm going to try to make this very simple. So the short of it is that we entrust the insurers offering Medicare Advantage plans to bill the government appropriately for the people that they provide coverage to. But the system, the payment system, is a little funky. And as a result, the insurers can get paid more the more diagnoses they put on an enrollee's record. As a result of that, it has been estimated by several different researchers that the insurers are putting lots of diagnoses on people's records that may be accurate diagnoses, but have nothing to do with how much they're spending on their enrollees' care or nothing to do with the treatment that their enrollees need. And as a result, the government is paying them about, it turns out, $1 trillion extra over the next 10 years. And by extra, what I mean is that if these people were in traditional Medicare, we would be spending $1 trillion less. So apples to apples, we have, if we're going to keep a level playing field and not pay more for people enrolled in Medicare Advantage than for people enrolled in traditional Medicare, we have an extra $1 trillion in that we're paying out. That's literally a waste, if not a fraud, that could be eliminated without affecting people's Medicare benefits and Medicare Advantage. Of course, the insurers would deny that because they want that money. But the reality is they'd still be getting literally as much as the government is spending for people in original Medicare to care for people. So they'd still have that same amount of money. They just have fewer profits. So this is a long way of saying that there's no need to cut $880 billion from Medicaid and harm low-income Americans who need the benefits of Medicaid, or kick them off Medicaid or reduce their benefits, whatever will happen as a result. And we know it will be tragic because there is this $1 trillion in waste. And in addition to the fact that there's this waste that can be eliminated, there is also the reality that these overpayments are eating into the Medicare trust fund and hurting Medicare and its solvency. And in addition as well, it is driving up everyone's Medicare Part B premiums. So by eliminating the waste and the fraud in Medicare Advantage, the government could protect Medicaid and it could protect the Medicare Advantage system from abuse. All it would be doing is not allowing the health insurers in Medicare Advantage to continue to gouge taxpayers and people in Medicare. It would reduce their profits. And that seems completely appropriate given where we are with Medicare and Medicaid today.
Thank you, Diane. And I think it's also important to have the larger discussion of what are our budget priorities. And we're trying to find this money to finance bigger tax breaks for billionaires and corporations. If we're looking to find savings, I think there are better things to spend that money on, such as expanding healthcare so that more Americans can get the healthcare they need and deserve. But unfortunately, that is not what the House is planning to vote on this week.
Unfortunately not.
Yeah. So stay tuned for what the results of the votes this week, whether Medicaid continues to be on an immediate chopping block or whether this is something that's going to continue to be discussed over the next few weeks. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today for Care Talk. Thank you, Diane and Louise, as always, for answering people's questions. Please text or call in your questions to 202-838-6837. Join us next week for more on healthcare in America and get your questions answered. And be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This is Care Talk.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.